Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by AOL Radio at AOL.com/podcasting. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 193 for May 4th, 2009. Toodaloo, Tuvaloo. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get two free books. Go to audible.com/twit2 and follow Audible on Twitter. User ID audible_com. And by GoToMeeting. Picture yourself on a phone call sharing and explaining something visual with GoToMeeting. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMeeting.com/twit. Hello, everybody. This is TWiT, episode 193. Some great people joining us today to talk about the week's tech stories in an informal and happy-go-lucky fashion, starting with the happy-go-lucky Dwight Silverman from the Houston Chronicle. And
hello.
Is it cron.com/blog? Is that right?
It's blogs.cron.com/techblog.
I'm going to change your lower third right now. And I just want to know, let you to know that all of the stories we're doing today, I stole from Dwight.
Yay.
He has a link list that is, I like to include stories that, you know, the panelists have already been thinking about and writing about. So I also stole stories from Veronica Belmont of Techzilla. Hi, Veronica.
That's not true. You didn't steal any stories from me.
You guys do tech news every day now, though, don't you?
We do our daily tip show. It's not tech news.
You don't cover tech news? Yeah, you do a little bit, don't you?
On the weekly show, usually.
Yeah. And then also with us, Harry McCracken of the Technologizer blog. Hi, Harry.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
Great. Great to have you back.
Nice to be here.
I was on the History Channel the other day, watching a history of computing in the 80s.
And they must show that 100 times a week, because I did that 5 years ago, and everywhere I go, people see that.
It's a good thing to do.
Funny enough, I've never seen that, but it's the most played thing I ever did by far.
It's really funny. They're talking about Atari and stuff. And actually, I thought there was something I got out of it, frankly, was they were talking about how Atari, the failure of Atari in the 2600, because it was an open platform. Atari did what we would today think was the right thing, which was to allow anybody to develop software for the Atari platform. And, of course, a lot of crap games were developed, and it killed the 2600. And I thought, well, that kind of applies a little bit to today, to the iPhone. I mean, that's what Apple does with the iPhone.
That's actually, Atari 2600 and iPhone is a pretty interesting comparison in a lot of ways.
Well, I mean, it's odd to compare the two, but Apple has an absolutely closed environment. And they're doing it for the same reason that Atari didn't do it. The same reason that Nintendo, looking at Atari, said, "Oh, we really can't let that happen. We better license everything." And as a result, Apple has full control, but they get a lot of heat from people who say it's not an open platform.
Certainly, none of today's gaming consoles are anywhere near as open as the early ones were.
No, they learned their lesson.
They all want to make money selling the games, even if they lose money on the consoles.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, some of the games that started on the Atari 2600 are now starting to show up on the iPhone. You see a lot of these classic games.
What goes around comes around.
I love that. Right. I love that. I want to see more ColecoVision games on the iPhone personally.
The Atom.
You know what they just released? If you're an old Mac person, you'll recognize that Myst is available for the iPhone. This shows you how powerful the iPhone platform. The full game. 100-something megabytes.
It's a huge download.
Did you get it already?
I didn't get it yet, but I saw the story today, actually, when I was going through the delicious links. I said, oh my gosh, I got to get that. That's so fun.
That's so cool. You must have been pretty little when Myst came out.
Yeah, what year was it?
I don't know.
What year did that come out?
1995 or so, I think, mid-90s.
Oh, okay.
Okay, I was like 13.
It wasn't that.
13 or 14.
Perfect. It was actually the perfect game for a 13-year-old. You know, that was exactly right for a 13-year-old.
That was the golden age of games on CD-ROM.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which lasted about a minute.
Well, and you know, as a corollary to that, this is the week that Encarta died.
Yeah.
Oh.
Talk about
that made me sad, actually, because I use that all
sad.
The time.
I think my kids grew up going through elementary school using Encarta on a CD-ROM as a way to study. And so when it went away, it was kind of like sad for all of us.
And it was a great program. And if you were to do a list of the top 10 best things Microsoft ever did, I think Encarta would be on that, because for the mid-90s, it was really well done.
I used it all the time for schoolwork. Definitely.
You're making us feel old now.
I'm sorry.
I reviewed it back then.
I've got that perspective, right?
I used it for schoolwork. Yeah. I mean, didn't they start with like Funkin' Wagnalls? They started with like the worst encyclopedia, the one that they gave away in the grocery store. And everybody.
That was the only one they could license.
They licensed
Britannica
everything.
Turned them down
they licensed that and Compton's and a bunch of others, and they
Compton's.
Added on to it.
Yeah.
They had a great user interface, though, and they were, you know, the multimedia aspect was great. Even Wikipedia today does not really do multimedia in the way that Encarta did.
You know, I remember using it a lot like Wikipedia, the way I use Wikipedia now, which was going to an article and then continuing to browse through related articles and just spending hours and hours just learning about totally random stuff because it was, you know, relevant to my interests or just, you know, something that was cool to see.
At the time it came out, there was Encyclopedia Britannica on CD-ROM, but it cost $1,000. Oh. It had no artwork of any type.
That was a smart move on their part. Where are they now? I guess they're where Encarta is. Actually, didn't really matter. Nobody needs the encyclopedia. I have a World Book Encyclopedia right here, printed World Book Encyclopedia, that I got because I thought the kids would use it. No, they never used it. They use Wikipedia. What happened? You know, the whole CD-ROM thing was a big flop.
Well, not at the time.
Was it, Dwight?
We bought it, particularly was for kids. And obviously, you know, a lot of games came on them. A lot of the early games, you know, shooters and popular PC games would not run unless the disc was in. So I guess that counts as a CD-ROM. But particularly for kids, a lot of educational software and so forth
came
on CD-ROM.
Well, that's what I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of like, I remember there were tours of museums. There were games like Myst. There was Encarta. I mean, some of those, I remember reading later that some of those titles sold dozens of copies. I mean, they'd put millions of dollars into production and they just, nobody would buy them. The internet completely superseded it, and it happened within a few. I mean, look, if it was 95.
The CD-ROM thing started about 1993, maybe. And by 95, the web was taking off. And so 680 megabytes or whatever a CD-ROM held went from being a huge amount of data to being nothing.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
I remember going to Staples. Go ahead.
Say again?
The web was generally free and CD-ROMs cost money.
Yeah. What were you saying, Veronica?
I was saying how I used to go to Staples and they would have these bargain bins just full of CD-ROM educational titles and games, and you could pick up a whole armload worth of for like, you know, $50.
But the educational market just died. I mean, that I feel kind of sad about. My kids did the Broderbund Living Books. Remember those? Did your kids do those, Dwight? The Living Books series?
Yeah, they loved it.
They were great. And they're gone. It was one generation got those, and now they're gone. And I don't know why that is.
That would be a perfect addition for the iPhone. If whoever holds the rights is listening, hey, let's make a great iPhone app.
It's pretty funny that you could get all of Myst. It's now on my phone, and the graphics are good. I mean, it looks pretty much, you know, it looks just the same.
Did you download it already?
No.
Did you get it?
No, I have. I was going to wait till after the show. I don't want to kill my bandwidth. It's like 100. What is it? 143 megabytes, something.
How much does it cost?
$5.99. It's not expensive.
And the original one was like $39.95 or something on CD-ROM.
Yeah,
remember that?
Yeah. I just think that's kind of a neat story.
You know, Dvorak is not on, and here we are already going down memory lane.
Yeah, yeah. What's wrong with us? We don't got the old guy on, and we're still doing it. All right, let's talk about the present. Disney buys into, this was a very interesting story, 30%, some say, of Hulu, and Disney's put all of the ABC shows on there, Lost, I mean, just a ton of shows on there. This is a huge victory for Hulu. This is a real proof that Hulu's the future of television, don't you think? Dwight, why did ABC see this as something they wanted to be part of?
Well, you know, this, I think it was probably in the works before this, but this was also about the same time that there was a report that Hulu had a huge increase in traffic. And I know that almost everybody I know has at least sampled Hulu. I hear from a lot of readers who ask about, who started asking about Boxy, even though they don't have a Mac or Linux. Boxy being the kind of the interface that can sit on top of the Mac or Linux or Apple TV and make it easier to look at internet video. And Hulu, they keep trying to block them, and they keep
coming Boxy
through.
Yeah.
I think there's just a lot more buzz, and people are kind of getting the idea of doing it over the web, and you know it has commercials just like regular television,
but
they're not as intrusive and they're not as long.
Yeah. Do you watch? Are you a Hulu watcher, Veronica?
Oh, yeah. I use Hulu all the time. I was really bummed out by the whole situation with Boxy in particular, because, you know, when I miss shows on TV, I like to watch them on Hulu, but I also like to still do it in the comfort of my own living room. I mean, my computer's great and all, but it's a lot better to be able to sit on the couch and control it that way. So this makes me even a little more angry, because now it's got all the ABC content on there, and NBC, rather. Is it ABC or NBC that just signed
ABC.
Up? I forgot.
ABC,
right?
ABC, yeah.
And I'm a big Lost fan, and I've wanted to watch
Lost
it on Hulu
there,
for a long time. Yeah. So it's kind of a disappointment for me, actually.
I use Hulu primarily when I travel. You know, when you're in a hotel room and you just don't want to, you know, you just kind of want to chill out for the evening. Hulu is how I watch television. I don't even turn on the television in the hotel room anymore. I just fire it up and catch up on stuff.
I love Hulu, and I watch people like Veronica and Colleen, younger people in their 20s. And I think a lot of times, I think the reason Hulu got pulled off of Boxy is because some of the content creators somehow thought that displaying it on a screen, on a computer screen, was different than displaying it on a TV. And they didn't want it displayed on the TV, right? For some crazy reason.
Yeah, they definitely complained directly to Boxy about that. And they tried to come up with some kind of workaround. Boxy worked very, very hard with them in order to keep that content on there. But at the end of the day, they wanted to pull it.
The downloads of our shows are on Boxy, odtv.me. I bet Texzilla's on Boxy, right?
Yep.
It's stupid of somebody like NBC to say, or Fox say, we don't want to be on Boxy. Because if you're not on Boxy, others will be. You know?
I think it's a huge problem for broadcast TV, because Hulu on Boxy is so good. It's such a good experience. But, you know, they're not making millions of dollars on ads on Hulu. If you look at the ads on Hulu, a lot of the time they're public service messages. And I think they're all afraid of the notion that they might be giving up those expensive Super Bowl type ad campaigns for whatever they can get for Hulu. And I think it's really regrettable that they're being obnoxious and screwing up Boxy. But I also, on some level, sort of understand why they're terrified about catching on.
This is, I think.
But don't you think it's short-sighted?
It
I mean,
yes, it's very short-sighted.
It's very
because
short-sighted.
Eventually, all TV will be that basic metaphor. It'll all come over the internet, and it's going to happen fairly soon. And
I just think people like Veronica and Colleen, the younger people, a screen is a screen is a screen. It doesn't make a distinction between it being on your screen in your living room, Veronica, and your computer, or does it?
Well, like I said, it is nice to be able to watch it in my living room.
You like to sit at the couch.
At the end of the day, I'm going to go where the content is.
Right. I think it's very good for people like you, for independent content creators. The big guys have, and this has always been the case, when you have an existing business, whether you're the record industry, the television business, the movie industry, and you don't want to cannibalize it, so you stay away, or the New York Times, so you stay away from these new distribution media because you go, oh, gosh, you know, it's going to cannibalize our TV viewing. That is an opening for everybody who doesn't have all that existing relationships. You know, that's
we don't have all the baggage.
Yeah.
Right. The other thing is that, you know, Harry mentioned that they don't have a lot of ads on there. But when they do have ads on Hulu, you don't have the choice to not watch them. When they play, you can't fast forward them.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, you can mute them. That's about as much control as you have. If I was an advertiser looking at the way people deal with ads, say, on a DVR now, where they can fast forward through them and skip them and certainly mute them, I would look at Hulu as more of an opportunity. Probably more people are actually sitting and watching the ads rather that's than, really, say, on a DVR.
Yeah.
That's a really great totally great comment, because it's true. I mean, I've sat through tons of commercials on Hulu and not even thought twice about it. But if I'm on my TV watching it over TiVo, I fast forward through those suckers as fast as my thumb can hit the button. So it's a captive audience when you've got them on Hulu there. They don't really have a way of not watching it unless they, you know, switch tabs, I guess, in their browser and mute it.
It does seem like Hulu's heart is in the right place, and that it's the content owners who are preventing them from doing things like Boxy. My sense is that if Hulu controlled that stuff, they'd be moving a lot more aggressively. And you have to give Hulu is owned by old Hollywood, but they really do a great job. The interface is great.
They did a deal with the devil, and now the devil wants his due.
Yeah, so they have to get those guys to understand, and sooner or later they will, but I hope it's sooner rather than later.
I'm also curious as to the number of people who watch Boxy on a computer, use Boxy on a computer.
I do, even
versus
though it's
on something like Apple TV.
Well,
if you're doing it that way, it just presents it, you know, in a really nice widescreen version. I use it on my 24-inch iMac. And in that case, it's just the same as watching it on Hulu.
Right.
I don't know how many people are actually using it, say, through Apple TV or some other hack where they're getting it on their big screen TV, which is what they're afraid of. So I'd love to see some numbers as to how people are actually using Boxy.
Well, and they're dumb to be afraid. And I think the ABC deal proves it, because ABC has its own website. You could watch those shows on the ABC website, but they saw the value of being on Hulu. And some of the value of Hulu is not just that it's another website. I think it has to be that it offers more opportunities. I bet you ABC, with a third of that company, pushes them back towards things like Boxy. They must. Otherwise, what have they gained by going to Hulu? Except, I guess there's more eyeballs. But, I mean, they put the stuff on ABC. Why would you buy Hulu if you've already got a website?
Disney historically has been fairly progressive in terms of adopting new technologies and being open-minded, and Robert Iger seems to be fairly smart about this stuff. So I would hope he would push them in the right direction.
And there's still a connection between ABC and Apple, right?
Well, that's actually the interesting thing. Yeah, I mean, Steve Jobs is on the board of both. Pixar is owned by Disney. But Business Week supposes that it actually hurts Apple because Apple, it doesn't create content, distribute it for free online. Hulu is going right up against Apple's model. Hulu's saying, yeah, not only do we own the content, but we're going to offer it to you for free. Yeah, you could buy it on the iTunes store, but wouldn't you want to get it for free?
The advantage that Apple has in this scenario is that it's very easy for you to download an episode of Lost, even though you are paying for it without commercials, though, and put it on your iPhone or iPod Touch and taking it with you on the go.
So which do you prefer?
It just depends on how you want to consume the content. I mean, at the end of the day, I travel enough that it makes sense for me to want to have it on my iPhone there so I can take it with me. But, you know, when I'm home, I'd rather just sit through the, you know, 15, 30-second commercials on Hulu and watch it that way now.
You know, I have an opinion on this stuff. One of the reasons we're doing live streaming video is because, you know, our bread and butter is still downloadable content, whether it's audio, we're going to start doing downloadable video. I think it's too hard for people. And I think that the generation that grew up with turning on the TV and watching prefers to watch on Hulu or live.twit.tv because you just go to a website and there it is. You don't have to figure out how to download it. You have to find the content, download it, put it on a device. So
I think there's something about having a tangible copy of what you want to watch. I think people like having a copy on their hard drive for watching later or using on different devices. I think there's still that feeling that goes way back to when we had everything on CDs and VHS and DVD. Streaming video is all well and good, but unless there's some kind of copy that you can refer to later, people feel like they're not getting that sense of value.
Well, you have to do both. I mean, I know that people want to TiVo it, right? I mean, we offered streaming video, and all that did was increase the drumbeat for downloadable video. But I think streaming is the future just because it's so easy. And if you want to download a copy, fine. But it's the starting point. And I think that's why Hulu is really, really, really important for these networks.
I think streaming is the impulse, and downloading is kind of the planning. So when you sit down to Hulu, it's kind of like, or you sit down, I think I'll watch some Hulu now. I don't think anybody says, oh, I'm going to go home and then after dinner, I'll sit down and watch Hulu. I think they do it on impulse.
Well, they do it on the road. They do that with their TV, though, right? They How many people? This is how we watch TV. You sit down and you watch TV.
Right. But I'm saying in terms of if you're planning it, you download a copy to watch later. You save it to your DVR. I think that's kind of the planning, the aforethought, and streaming is more of an impulse.
So you don't think it's that it's so hard. You think that it's just that the, I mean,
it's easy. It's actually easy. Streaming is easy.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's not merely planning. It's that it's hard to figure out. I think the early adopters are going to figure this out. The four of us have figured it out. Anybody listening to Twits figure this out. But if you're going to get the mass audience, which, you know, Hulu and Disney want, you got to make it really easy for them. And right now getting a podcast, video or audio, is not that easy. I mean, I don't know. Veronica, Texilla is downloadable only, or do you stream it too?
You can watch it on the site and you can also download it.
That's it. You have it on the site and it's playable. Mm-hmm. What do you know? What percentage of people watch it on the site versus downloading it?
You know, I don't. I have a feeling that it's more downloads than streams, but don't quote me on that. I'm really not sure.
Oh, it's for us. It's more downloads for sure, but it's a surprise. Like 40% come to our site and listen to the audio, which to me seems inconvenient. I mean, but as far as our stream is far more, you know, maybe I don't know. I'll have to check. 4,000 or 5,000 people are watching this compared to the 180,000 that will download it.
I suspect they listen to it while they work.
Yeah.
That's kind of just runs over long.
That's kind of the new model, I think, is, yeah, you got it going all the time. It only works if you know, that's what I think. That's why we're doing this stream. I mean, I might be crazy. I don't know. But that's why we're doing the stream, is that people will just go there and they leave it running all day. It's like having the radio in the background.
It's like having radio. Yeah. In fact, for some businesses, it's an issue. Yes. We haven't done it.
We're
we
blocked
haven't done it in a while.
We're blocked in a lot of businesses.
Right, because of the bandwidth.
Yeah.
So I think that's, you know, it becomes an, but a lot of people do use internet radio, and streaming audio and video is kind of the way they used to have a clock radio next to their desk all day.
Well, get this. Talk about bandwidth. Cablevision, which has always been kind of the most forward-looking cable company, I think. They pretty much serve, it's mostly New York City, Long Island, a little bit of New Jersey, a little bit of Connecticut. They have announced that they are going to offer uncapped, this is a response to Time Warner and Comcast, right? Uncapped 101 megabit service starting next week in their entire service area for $99 a month. I'd buy it. I'd buy it.
I wonder how fast it will really be, given that any broadband I've ever had has never come anywhere close to what they claim on a reliable basis.
Yeah, well, but if they claim 100, you might actually get 50, right?
True. That would be fabulous.
It's DOCSIS 3, which is capable of that.
And it depends on what, you know, the server you're talking to is capable of giving you too, and what the rest of the pipes between here and there.
None of my servers are 100 megabit. If you came to our server, if 10 people with 100 megabit connections came to our server, that'd be saturated. They'd be over.
Right.
Nope. I mean, that's a gigabit right there. We can't do that. However, I think the more important word in there is uncapped. This is why competition is so important. There is no competition in the cable industry, but I just love the idea that when Time Warner has, you know, they've gone back and forth. The latest is, well, all right, maybe we won't do capped service, but they were talking really low caps. Even Comcast with its 250 gigabyte cap was bothering some people. It bothers me because if you watched all of our content, it could easily eat up 250 gigabytes right. a month. So I like this. But what it's also saying, I remember talking to these Cablevision guys at CES about 5 or 6 years ago. And I said, why don't you guys just think of yourself as a internet company? Just provide bits. And they said, that's not our business model. We can't do that. We would go bankrupt. There's not enough value in bits. We have to sell premium content. And I think that's why Comcast and Time Warner are saying we're going to do caps, is they're afraid of people using this high-speed internet to get all their video, to watch everything on Hulu. So this is almost Cablevision capitulating, saying, okay, if we can get $100 out of you, I guess you can get all your content on the internet.
Well, you know, and as you watch AT&T, which has not gone into this yet, but keeps talking that they, as though they might start capping things, as they get more and more involved and sell more and more subscriptions to Uverse, they're starting to pay more attention to it. And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, because they have to sell premium content too, that you don't see AT&T getting capped.
I think when one company like Cablevision comes along, it might cause a shift. I would love it if all these companies would say, And I think, you know what? What do they need to make? I mean, $100 is a lot of money. If they could get all their customers to pay them $100, wouldn't they be happy? I mean, how much? What's your cable bill, Dwight?
My cable bill, I use unbundled Comcast. I think it's 8 megabits for about close to $70. If I bundled it with Comcast cable, it would be about $50.
And do you don't get any TV on your Comcast?
No, I use UVerse television and Comcast internet.
So if you combine the television and the internet, what are you spending? Probably $150, right?
Probably about $120 altogether. But it's less actually than when we were using TiVo and Comcast and television and internet. So it's actually less.
You're overall. What scares these companies because you're spending less and less money as you get
right,
more
I'm
and more.
Right, I'm breaking it up. I'm not bundling.
How about you, Veronica? I mean, you're somebody who watches a lot of internet television. Do you have a big cable bill for TV?
I think our cable bill total, oh geez, I pay it automatically, so I don't even remember what the charge is. I think it's like $140 for TV and internet.
That's a lot.
I'm guessing it's up there.
So if you were smart enough to get all your TV via this 101 megabit connection, you'd be saving money at $100.
Yeah.
And they'd be saving a customer. They may be happy to get your $100 instead of your $150 just because at least they'd keep you. How about you, Harry? What do you think? Is that...
You know, it's... For me, I think I also pay it automatically. I believe it's $140 for TV, internet access, and a phone line, which I don't really use.
Ooh, phone line. I don't have a phone line. That's fancy.
Oh, are you anyway, VoIP? Are
I'm
you all
bit
VoIP?
Of that, though, so I'm going to give Comcast less money, and if Comcast gave me incentives to give them more money, it would be a good thing for them.
Right.
It sounds like we have the same Comcast deal.
And of course, I signed up for the triple play at some absurdly low rate and then discovered it didn't include HD. It didn't include even really basic TV channels like MSNBC. So the moment I actually started to get it, it jumped from $50 for triple play or whatever to $140.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that this could be the first domino. The Cablevision may have finally said, you know, this is the way it is. Let's at least get the $100. And when people start looking at their cable bill, as soon as they get smart enough to figure out that they can watch everything for free using the internet, this may be the beginning of the end for this whole mess.
That's true.
It's a huge conflict of interest right now, you know, for Comcast to say, well, we don't want you to use VoIP. We don't want you to download files. We don't want you to watch streaming video because you're undermining our business model. That they're not going to get away with that. And I think the new FCC commissioner, Julius Genachowski is not going to go for that. I think that they're seeing the writing on the wall. The regulatory environment's not in their favor anymore, and I think they might be saying, "All right." But is $100 too much?
Cablevision.
Cablevision's not that big. They're small, but they're very technologically sophisticated. I would say they're the most sophisticated cable company. Their Optimum Online has always been very fast and good, and they are in a very dense metro. I mean, they are in the most dense metro of all. So that makes them, I'm sure, very profitable. They don't have to string as much cable to get to the customers.
But in the ecosystem of cable television and cable internet providers, how influential are they? In other words, for example, if Comcast were to do this, that would be, I would say that you may have a point that it could be the domino. But Cablevision is a relatively small player compared to Comcast and Charter and Time Warner. And so I'm not sure that... You know, I'll play the John Dvorak role here. I don't think so.
maybe it's a little wishful thinking on my part. It might be a little wishful thinking on my part. But what I do believe is Cablevision is kind of at the forefront of all this. They're very advanced thinking. So that's why I think they might be a bellwether for this.
Although in looking at the statements that Time Warner made when it backed away from its tiered and multiple cap service, which it was testing right down the road here in Beaumont, when they backed away from that, you know, kind of their closing word was this is what we want to do and we're going to figure out a way to do it.
We're going to do it, yeah.
Right. But I was real intrigued by your comment about the regulatory environment. I wonder if, you know, granted they had a consumer uprising, but I also wonder if they didn't look at what was happening at the FCC and said, we got two fronts against us here.
Genachowski is big on internet net neutrality, huge net neutrality guy. In fact, we got to get Debbie Jones wants to come on the show, and I'll get her on maybe next week. She's big on this broadband access, universal broadband access. Janikowski, very big on that, too. I think those are two important initiatives already that are in the forefront. And I think this impacts them. I think that they're this is not the friendly FCC. And it wasn't so friendly in the last 8 years, but this is not the friendly FCC that they might have had. Comcast had their own, you know, tussles with the FCC for the last few years. But I think you're going to I think there's some push in that direction. I'd love to see that.
I hope you're right.
I hope I'm right, too. And I hope you're wrong.
I'd be happy to be wrong.
I hope you're wrong.
Please make me wrong.
Let's talk about. Well, I'll tell you what. When we come back, I do. There are a few other things we might want to talk about: the Palm Pre and the Pixie. So you know, there's a little trouble in paradise. We'll talk about that. Time Warner is going to spin off America Online. Could be good for both. Apple says they might want to design their own chips, and 60% of Twitters are quitters within the first month. All of that coming up in just a little bit. I do want to mention audible.com. You use sometimes Sword and Laser, your science fiction podcast, Veronica. Don't you use Audible, listen to science fiction on Audible?
I do. I'm actually listening to the Eye of the World series right now on Audible.
I was hoping. I was going to ask
the Wheel,
you.
The Wheel of Time series.
Wheel of Time. That sounds familiar. Who does that?
That is Robert Jordan.
Is it good?
Is that right? Is that right? Sometimes I get my authors confused. Yeah, it's really good. Right now I'm on the Dragon Reborn, which is book 3, and I listened to the second
book
also. Oh my
god, there's like a dozen of them.
There is literally a dozen.
Oh my god.
I think they're working on book 12 right now.
and do they go one to the other, or are they tell me a little bit about these stories.
It's a one continuous story, and I read the first one in regular book form, and then I was reading so many other books at the time that I was like, I want something to take with me to go during my commute. So I downloaded the second and third book and listened to them while traveling and also during my commute, just sometimes at home also. And there's two different voice actors that read all the parts, and they do a really great job.
Well, if you are in a book club, that's a great reason to join Audible. It's a great way to read your books. They have beefed up their science fiction section immensely with their Audible Frontiers and so forth. And I think I'm just going to make this a recommendation. The Eye of the World, book one of the Wheel of Time.
There you go.
And there are 11 Wheel of Time. See, I love it. If you find something you're really into. Book one, by the way, 30 hours.
It's a long, long
Holy
book.
Cow.
Yeah. They're all pretty long.
Are they all that long?
Yep.
Is it fantasy? What is it?
It's fantasy. Yeah. And actually Robert Jordan passed away this past year. And so they're getting another author to finish the series on book 12.
Isn't that awful when that happens? You know,
I know. Can
so
you believe
close.
It? It was going to be the last book. And so it's someone who's really familiar with the storyline and the characters though, and who writes in a similar tone. So hopefully it'll be as good as all the other ones have been.
This is Kate reading and Michael Kramer.
Yes.
Let me play a little bit of this just so you can hear kind of what it sounds like.
Have you the voice, stranger? It will soon be time for the singing. And here all are welcome to take part. Ilyana, my love, we have a guest. Ilyana, where
is this going to be one of those books where they got like 8,000 names you have to keep track of?
A little bit. They stick with the same characters, so you get used to them. And it's funny because the male voice actor does female voices in the book, and vice versa. There's a female voice actress who
That's
does
fine.
The male parts. But you get used to it so quickly.
Oh, yeah. There's two different styles of audiobooks. One where the guy, like Jim Dale, does every voice, and everyone's a distinct character. In fact, it's funny because the Harry Potter books in the U.S. were recorded by Jim Dale. In Audible England, it's Stephen Fry. And Fry is much more of the thing where he gets slight differences, but he's not trying to act out every voice. And it's just a different style. I kind of like the Fry style, to be honest. I don't mind it at all. All right. Well,
it's just a slight difference between the different voices.
Yeah.
It's subtle enough that you can tell who's talking, but at the same time, you know, it's not too distracting.
Sometimes it takes me out of it. When all of a sudden he's talking like this, you know, hello, and it just kind of, it's like the guy's kind of a little crazy, to be honest with you. So I kind of like that. I like it a little bit more subtle in my book. Have you read? I'm reading. Talk about another long series. It's what's his name? I think you would like this. It's another fantasy series. I'm reading on Audible.com. I'm seeing if I can find it here.
So you say you're reading on Audible.
Yeah.
I say listening.
I get in trouble. People say, you're not reading. You're listening. But I am reading. It's every word of the book. What's the difference whether it comes through your eyeballs or your ear hole?
Your ear hole. Good point.
What's the difference? It's reading. It's reading a book. I think it counts. I'm going to... Anyway, you can call it whatever you want. Go to audible.com right now. If you actually go to audible.com/twit2, you get the Platinum Plan. You're going to need it if you're going to read The Wheel of Time. The Platinum Plan gives you 2 books a month, and your first 2 books are free. So you want this.
I have the regular standard plan, the 1 book a month.
You're a gold.
But that's all I need because it takes so long to get through these.
You don't have a long commute. Hey. You don't have a long commute. If you had a 2-hour, as I used to, I'd go through 3 books a month. I know people who have 2 platinum plans because they do 4 books a month.
You're a fast listener.
Yes. You can, by the way, turn
speed
up. You can turn the speed up on these. I don't.
How fast can you go and still understand it?
The iPod only lets you go slow, medium, fast. It doesn't. So I don't know. It's like 30%. It doesn't. It's, you know what? Your brain's very good at absorbing. In fact, it turns out it's better at hearing stuff if people talk quickly.
So it doesn't sound like Alvin the Chipmunks?
No. It's the iPod does some sort of pitch shifting. Anyway, this plays on the iPod, the Kindle, the Zune, pretty much every portable device. I'm told that GPS devices are big for Audible because people have them in their car. They often have memory and they all play Audible. So give it a try. Audible.com/twit2. I'm going to let Veronica pick our book this week. Book 1 of The Wheel of Time, 30 Hours of the Eye of the World by Robert Jordan. And then you can go to swordandlaser.com and talk about it.
Yep, that was one of our recent books, so we actually had a whole podcast on that one as well.
So you do a podcast, and then is it like a book group where you have like forums and people will come and talk and that kind of thing, or how does that work?
Yeah, we have Ning forums at swordandlaser.ning.com where we do all our discussions about the books that we're reading, and then once a month, Tom and I get together, Tom Merritt from CNET, of course, and discuss the book a little bit and talk about readers' comments and just, you know, regular book club stuff.
Did Tom like this book? Just give us a little...
Yeah, he liked it.
Oh,
we
good.
Moved it.
All right, then I'll read it. It's not a chick book.
It's not a chick book. Don't worry.
Well, there are fantasy books that are just really romance novels, right?
Yeah, you might not like the Jacqueline Carey novels.
Right.
Yeah, I'll put that out.
Some of them are kind of romancy, and then there's some like sword fighting in this, right?
Yeah, there's a good amount of sword fighting and magic.
And explosions. Don't forget explosions.
As long as they're magical explosions. Apple has decided, this is a very interesting story. I don't know what to make of it, that they've been hiring. You remember they bought PA Semi, so they have engineers in-house that could design chips. It's not clear whether these are ARM. They're basically ARM chips for, I would assume, the iPhone, but maybe other portable devices, including the rumored tablet iPhone. And now there are more than 100 job listings for Apple looking for chip designers, chip engineers, quality control engineers. It's pretty clear Apple has decided to design and build its own chips.
So they would be taking that away from like Samsung, for example.
Yeah, if it's ARM.
Yeah,
if it's ARM. But, you know, what if they decided to do this for desktops, too? And here's one conspiracy theory. It would be a way. One of the problems Apple has is it's really easy to build a Hackintosh, right? It's trivial. You could put OS X on a, I have it on an MSI Wind. It's easy. They haven't been able to shut that down. If you made your own chips that only you sold, you wouldn't have that problem. You'd have absolute control of hardware and software.
But haven't they been down that road before? I mean, to a certain extent, their early processors were
primarily
used in their machines.
The
PowerPC. The PowerPC processor was a joint development between IBM and them and Motorola. And it seems like they've kind of have done that before. And then they moved to Intel because of performance and heat and battery issues.
So you think it would be a bad idea?
I think I could see them doing it for a handheld device. I think that makes a lot of sense. And increasingly, things like the iPhone are becoming more and more a part of what they do. And I can see them wanting to get some kind of an edge and hold it in that area. But for desktops, at this point, I think there's a benefit for them using a relatively open platform. I think the percentage of people who are actually doing Hackintoshes aren't enough to really impact their sales.
I feel like it's more of them trying to control their supply line, because, I mean, wasn't it back in the day when the iPhone first started coming out that Samsung couldn't meet up with the demands for the chips, and that kind of restricted how many iPhones were coming out at first?
That's a good point.
Actually control their own manufacturing line with the chips, they might not have to worry about that kind of situation. And also, Samsung is technically a competing company, and they have to worry about less leaks that way if they aren't putting in orders for new products.
Although presumably somebody other than Apple will be manufacturing these chips, so they'll still have that issue.
I really feel like the
operating system, which is currently on the iPhone, is going to be around after there are no longer Macintoshes as we know them now. And I don't know whether Apple is thinking the way I am, but I think they could be preparing themselves for that, because I think we're at the beginning of the end of desktop PCs.
Wait a minute. Now, this is interesting. You think desktop PCs are going away?
Eventually. I mean, I really believe that the phone is going to be the new PC over time. We're at the beginning of the end of Windows and Wintel. And I don't know whether Apple is thinking that way, but I feel fairly confident that the descendants of the iPhone will be around after there are no longer descendants of today's MacBooks or iMacs. And they'll probably be a little bit more proprietary than today's Macs.
It'd be a wise thing for them to plan for an era, a post-PC era.
I sure would be if I were them.
Oh, that's really interesting. It's the kind of thing Apple would do. They're really, they do think ahead like that in a way that a lot of manufacturers don't. Huh. What do you think of that, Dwight? Do you think that's a good, that's a reasonable scenario? Is a PC, how soon? What's your time frame for that, Harry?
You know, I always feel like it's better to guess that things will happen more quickly than you expected. So I feel like a decade from now we'll be well into sort of a primarily post PC era. Not completely, because there are still mainframes out there. But I think that most of the things that people do on traditional computers today, they will be doing on something which is a descendant of a phone at some point. Large screens and large keyboards, but there's no reason why you can't use them with phones, too.
Oh, that's interesting. I heard somebody describe the iPhone as being the multimedia server that everybody maybe that was you, Harry. Did you write that? That the iPhone is kind of – everybody was talking about the multimedia server controller in the home, and that the iPhone is turning into that?
Well, I mean, people have written about the idea that maybe the iPhone is going to turn into the next Apple TV.
Right.
You don't even really need the Apple TV if you have a TV with an internet connection or Wi-Fi and an Apple and an iPhone. It might be how you get media onto the TV directly. And maybe so. There's kind of no technological reason why you can't do it, particularly as you get faster access to stuff in the cloud. I feel like the cloud and the phone will replace the PC.
You're just looking for an interface into the cloud, basically.
Yeah.
Something that's user-friendly and easy to get online with.
Well, that's what OnLive...
That you can take with you on the go.
That's what Steve Perlman's trying to do with OnLive. He's saying you don't need a graphics chip to play high-end video games. We'll do it all for you on our servers. All you need... In fact, it's ironic because the OnLive controller looks a little bit like an iPhone.
Have you talked about that a lot on the show?
No. You're the gamer expert. What do you think of that? For people who didn't hear about this, we talked a little bit about it after GDC, the Game Developers Conference. Steve Perlman announced this. He has big partners, Electronic Arts, Atari. It looks pretty real. The idea being you'd sign up for the service. You could use an old, low, cheap PC or buy one of their kind of interface devices. And attach it to your big screen TV and now play games even as high-end as Crysis. Mm-hmm. They do the rendering on their servers and with some proprietary technology. I'd be worried about the latency, but...
Yeah, I think that's probably the biggest worry is the latency issues, lag issues, especially with bandwidth caps. Is that going to be a major problem in the future?
I'll tell you my conspiracy theory. This is the cable company. This relies on a deal with the ISPs because that's who you're going to end up buying this service from. You're going to go to Comcast. Comcast say, you want our gaming package, $10 a month. You can play any game. Then they prioritize. They do QoS stuff with OnLive. Mm-hmm. OnLive, in other words, I think OnLive's whole business model relies on partnership with the internet service providers.
I absolutely agree with you. I think this is something you're going to see on Comcast boxes. I think that's probably where they're planning on going with this in the near future. Because that makes total sense. I mean, if you don't need to have a separate console or a separate PC, you want it just on your TV right there. If it's on your cable box already, you don't need to have to worry about it. You just need a controller to play it on.
And it introduces, I mean, from Atari and EA's point of view, it introduces a whole new group of casual gamers who don't own PS3s and Xbox 360s as customers. It broadens their base. No piracy. Makes a lot of sense for all the players. It's a technical problem, but I think the ISPs can solve that one.
I mean, then you have to be, you have to make sure that everyone has the same kind of level of connection, or I guess you'd have to make sure that the host at least has a very high speed connection, because when you get 16 people playing on the same game, there's going to be some problems. I mean, there's problems now with the systems that we already have set up.
When this happens, though, not only does cloud computing become capable of, you know, word processing and spreadsheets and calendaring and email, cloud computing becomes capable of high-end computing, video editing. I mean, gaming's just the beginning of all this. So I think, Harry, you might be right.
The cloud, though, has to get a lot more reliable, and you do have to have the bandwidth issues. Before people, I think, well, you know, Veronica mentioned earlier, people want to have a physical copy. And I think that before you get to the point where people trust that and that's where their primary computing is done, it's got to get a lot faster and a lot more reliable. And you don't have to worry about bandwidth caps. That is serious.
Definitely. I mean, even Gmail, as cool as it is, I mean, I'd say about 15% of the time, I have minor to major problems getting my email off of Gmail.
And you can't complain. It's beta.
Always beta.
You can't complain. It's beta.
I hear they're going to change the name of the company from Google to beta.
We actually.
And if Google can't scale this stuff, nobody is going to has it figured out yet. So it does have to get way more reliable.
It's you've painted an interesting picture, though, Harry, of a world with very simple devices that aren't PCs connected to very powerful devices on the cloud.
That's my guess. I mean, I worked at PC World for years, and who knows? Maybe I'm overreacting to shift in the opposite direction and think about the future. But so often in the past, stuff has happened more quickly once it's got going than you would have expected. I mean, the whole thing with digital music is only about 11 years old.
Yeah.
And think how much 11 years.
Well, and here's a prediction beyond the cloud. At some point, as these cycles go, because, you know, essentially the cloud is a return to mainframes and terminals, we're gonna start talking about the personal cloud, where you have your own server at your house that is that ultimately other people will be able to play on, and remotely you'll be able to connect up to your own system that you rely on. It'll come back to that eventually.
Some of that's there. HPPS Start server does that now.
Right.
Yeah.
This also relies on ubiquitous internet, because we're not talking about just a direct connect in the house now. I'm going to go out the door and I want this device to also work there, right? Everywhere. But I think we're getting close to that. I mean, all of these pieces seem to be falling in place. I hadn't really thought about this, Harry, but I think we might be heading quickly to the post-PC era, and it might be faster than we think.
But I mean, we're having so much trouble even just trying to get blanketed Wi-Fi in major cities that would seemingly support it, like San Francisco. That's a major hurdle too. I mean, if you're not blanketed in Wi-Fi wherever you go, how are you going to access your content? I mean, 3G is one thing, but I was in a restaurant today that didn't even have edge connection. And so,
ooh, how did you survive?
I know. I couldn't even, you know, I couldn't do the Twitter on my phone while I was eating. What a shame.
That, you know, damn, they should put a sign up on a restaurant to say, you can't Twitter here. I mean, that's terrible.
But, you know, there's still major hurdles to the whole cloud situation, especially on the go.
Zagat has to add a new thing, you know, food quality, service, decor, Twitter capability. It'll be a whole new section.
Cell phone reception.
Yeah.
There should be, there's Wi-Fi in Zagat now. Don't they have a Wi-Fi listing in the.
Do they really?
Zagat?
Oh,
I think so. Yeah. I was at a restaurant last night, a fairly fancy one in Houston called Churrasco's, which if you're ever in Houston, it's the place to go for South American steaks. Mm. And,
Let's go. We're all on our way. We'll be right there.
and I'm buying.
Okay.
They had a I had my iPhone with me, and I happened to check it, and they had free Wi-Fi, their own Wi-Fi. Now this is the kind of place where this is a really nice place to eat, and almost the kind of place where if someone whips out an iPhone, it's semi frowned upon. But they had free Wi-Fi for their customers, and I was pretty surprised and pleased.
Well, fancy, it is odd in a fancy restaurant to have.
Yeah.
But you know, everybody does it now. And in fact, it's almost the bane of modern life is that everybody's not looking at where they're all looking at their iPhone.
Both my daughter and I, now have iPhones. We got my daughter one a while back, and we sit in the living room, you know, while my wife watches television or whatever, and we're both like going on our screens.
Yeah, and I can't watch TV without a screen in my lap anymore.
That's right. But what's interesting
is it's like picture in picture.
Yeah, exactly.
I no longer sit there with my laptop. I use the iPhone instead of the laptop I used to have.
This is going to sound really bad. Ryan and I actually have a touch that we keep in the living room for exactly that purpose. It's the living room iPod touch. So if you need to look up like a cheat in a game or something about an actor on a TV show, you've got the iPod touch there.
See, this
is when Apple does its tablet, its alleged tablet.
This is going to happen next month. This is going to happen next month.
Right. You will have that on your coffee table instead, Veronica.
I think and Ryan are the couple of the future. We need to watch them. There need to be glass, one-way glass put into your apartment.
Oh, no.
Reality TV.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
And we will see what the future is going to be like. The future is now. Ryan Block, who is the host of GDGT and former founder of Engadget, who is, you know, I mean, between the two of you, you must be completely wired. I mean...
It gets a little scary sometimes. Yeah,
you're not one of those couples that goes to a restaurant and sits across from each other and talks via IM, are you?
No, we're not that bad. There's actually kind of an unspoken rule that you can take out the iPhone after the check has arrived.
Oh, that's good.
No iPhone until the check has arrived.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, I like that.
There's some etiquette here. You have
to make some kind of etiquette because this is like the final frontier. You have to make some ground rules early in the game.
It's the etiquette for the new world.
Yeah.
I love that. So the you were talking about how Apple struggled with supply problems. It's apparently that at least one analyst says Palm's going to have some problems. They cut back their initial order for the Pre from 1 million to just a few hundred thousand, not, as some thought, to create an artificial scarcity, but because they cannot make enough of them. Mike Garrington at TechCrunch told me that he thought that he heard that the Pre was kind of cheesy feeling in the hand. And he and others now in Gadget also have broken the story that there's a Pixie device, which is a much smaller Pre that will come out just a few months later with an actual keyboard instead of a soft. Oh, no, I guess the Pre has a slide out keyboard, but it'll have be more like the Centro, where it's a smaller screen and a keyboard right on like a candy bar phone. And some say that's the one you want. Both will run the new Palm Web OS. Palm's betting the farm on this one. Would it be disastrous if they couldn't get enough to market?
Seems like
yes.
Have you played with anybody played with a Pre here?
They don't really let people touch them hardly ever, even in demos. I've seen it close up, and in terms of software, it does look terrific.
I've seen it in a guy's hand, but they won't. They didn't let us touch it.
Oh, there's a cat behind you. Watch out. He may leap.
Oh, I know. He got in. That's Mr. Little Jeans. Or at Mr. Little Jeans on Twitter, if you're interested.
I would laugh at you, but my dog has a Twitter account, too. So. I did not create it.
Don't let our cat near the Twitter.
No. I had a caller on the radio show today say, my cat was sleeping on my Lenovo keyboard, and now the... backspace, delete, and enter key won't work. I said, you didn't sit on the cat while it was on the keyboard, did you? A little something came out there. What happened? Anyway, we don't know what the story is on that one. So I think the Pre, we agree, the Pre is very important for Palm's continued survival.
There's a huge amount of anticipation with this device. And I think if they don't deliver big, very early, people are going to start calling it as a failure.
Yes.
And that's really depressing to me because it could do well over time. But, you know, people are so looking forward to seeing how it does right away, right off the bat. And, you know, comparing it to the success of the iPhone when it first came out, that, you know, it's a lot of anticipation there, a lot of I don't know. I mean, Palm definitely went out on a limb with this, and the reception so far, at least when we saw it at CES for the first time, was very good. So I hope if they can meet up with demands, it'll continue, you know, to go along on that positive route.
I'm going to get in line. I'll go to the Sprint store and buy one. I'm going to get in line.
Is it similar to kind of what happened with the G1, which had a huge amount of hype and a lot of anticipation mm-hmm. before it? And they've sold, you know, a decent amount
of
it. It has not
T-Mobile
been the game changer.
1 million, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it definitely hasn't been a game changer.
No.
It's going to be hard for either T-Mobile or Sprint to change any game, given that, you know, they're the weakest of the big carriers. And if the pre came out on Verizon, say, it would have a bigger chance at being huge instantly.
Do you credit?
And I say that as somebody who's very excited about the pre. Right. I might switch to Sprint to get a.
Yeah.
I mean, Sprint has really great data, but they just don't have the numbers there. There's not enough people on Sprint, and I don't know if Sprint has a big enough draw to get people to switch over for this one device.
That's the real problem right now. If you want an iPhone, you have to go to AT&T. You want a G1, you have to go to T-Mobile. This is not good for consumers. I wish they wouldn't do this, but I guess it's good for the companies. Do you credit the rumor that Apple might be doing a deal with Verizon, putting in the iPhone or something like it, or maybe an iPhone Lite on the Verizon network?
It makes some sense in some ways, and it doesn't make any in another. For one thing, if Apple were to do it now, they'd have to do it with CDMA, which doesn't have a long shelf life. But on the other hand, with LTE coming along and them swapping out phones every year, like it seems that they're on that cycle, it would give them a foothold with Verizon and would expand their market share quite a bit. So it's probably good for a short-term play. And then if they keep up with the technology, it'll do good in the long term.
Yeah. I like Android, and now we're seeing a lot of news that Android's going to show up on other devices, that Google will put the Android operating system or offer the Android operating system on some netbooks.
I think the problem with the G1 is that it's just a little too geeky for the average consumer.
Oh, you think that's
I don't, you know, that's the only thing I can think
it's
of because it's a cool device. It's a little bit on the large side compared to most of the cell phones that are out there these days. Well, not ones with sliding keyboards, I guess, but I just feel like it hasn't caught on with that regular consumer set for one reason or another. And maybe it has to do with Android. I don't know.
Well, Android Cupcake was a version 1.5 is now being pushed out to the T-Mobile. I keep waiting for it to show up on mine. Rumors are it really improves performance, adds nice features, including a soft keyboard. Maybe that's all that the G1 needs. I mean, a million phones is respectable. So, you know, it's a third of Apple's sales in the same time period, but it's respectable.
It doesn't have the apps, though. The development, developer crowd has not come to it. If you go and look through the store that is available for the G1, there's not a lot there.
Yeah,
certainly not as what's compared to the Mac to the iPhone. And I think that's the big deal with the iPhone is the apps.
Developers.
Right.
They've got 35,000 apps. They've sold a billion of them.
Well, that's the thing. I read a great article recently about a done by an iPhone developer, and he was responding to a lot of criticism about why developers haven't been creating more apps for Android. And the reason being is there's just not the amount of people there that are buying these applications. I mean, so many rabid fans of iPhone applications who are just downloading apps constantly from the iTunes App Store, they're not getting that same kind of response with Android and with the G1. So obviously it makes more sense for them to focus their attentions on something like the iPhone apps, as opposed to doing it for Android.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's always been the case. Whatever platform gets the most apps is going to win. And that's why Windows for so long beat Macintosh. If you get the developers behind you, you're going to have an advantage in the marketplace. Let's talk about Amazon just bought Stanza, speaking of iPhone. And Stanza is the best e-reader, much better than Amazon's own Kindle e-reader on the iPhone. And it's an interesting choice to buy LexCycle, which is the company that makes Stanza. Do you use Stanza, Veronica? It's a really good ebook.
No, I didn't actually, but I just bought a Kindle this week and I got it in the mail on Thursday.
How do you like it?
So I love it. I freaking love it. But I downloaded the the Kindle app for the iPhone and I haven't used it yet, but I didn't use Stanza before because I've always had a hard time with ebook readers on the iPhone.
Stanza's pretty good.
Is it good? It's my eyes. You know, my eyes just get so strained after reading on the tiny screen for too long.
You can pinch the text to make it bigger or smaller. So you can get big fonts. But you're right. I mean, it's not as good as the Kindle. So you like the Kindle.
I absolutely. I'm so happy with it.
You freaking like it.
I fracking love it.
Fracking love it. You know, it's funny.
We're escalating.
I don't know. Is frack worse than frick? I saw some stats that said that more than half of the Kindle buyers are over 50. And a third of them are over 60. And I wasn't surprised at all. I showed my 75-year-old mom my Kindle. And she said, I've got to have this because the font, the text size, you can get it big enough. And she can read. She said, I'd stopped reading because I couldn't. The text was too small on printed books. And she loves the Kindle. She loves it that she can order a book and it appears there. She loves the form. So she's getting one. I hope she's not listening. She's getting one for Mother's Day.
Oh, what a guy.
That's a good gift for Mother's Day. But she really likes it. So that's interesting. The Kindle's audience is not the young, hip kids.
It's pretty expensive. It's for a young, hip kid.
I guess so.
It's the cost of an entry-level laptop.
Yeah, that's true. But, hey, look, Veronica bought one. And she freaking loves it.
I had to sell part of my kidney.
But you're young. You can afford that.
Yeah.
You got an extra.
So has there been any word if Amazon is going to replace its Kindle app for the iPhone with the Stanza app?
You got to think.
I'm sure they'll probably integrate it, huh?
Yeah.
I like the iPhone app for Kindle. I've read a couple of books with it, and it doesn't bother my eyes that much, but the font is very nice. It's the same font that the New York Times uses on its app, which is also very readable. And I like it. I mean, I don't have a Kindle, but I've bought a couple of books to
download,
read on the iPhone.
Download Stanza and see what you think.
Stanza did a blog post saying they had no plans to make any change to the app or add new sources of content. And if they're owned by Amazon, how can Amazon not essentially replace Kindle for the iPhone, which is not that great, with Stanza, which is so much better?
Interesting. Yeah.
I think they must. That must be the plan. The other advantage is Stanza is worldwide, right? You could buy Stanza anywhere. It would open up a market. Well, maybe they don't want that global market because of the publishing rights issues. But it would open up, you know, everybody could use it. It's a much better reader. The big thing about the Kindle app, the only advantage the Kindle app has is that when you read on the Kindle app, it updates your Kindle and vice versa. So when you get to page 69 on the Kindle, it's suddenly page 69 on the Kindle app. That's all I'd have to add to Stanza, that and one more source, Amazon. It wouldn't be a big change. So when do they say that? Harry, did they say that after the sale?
Yeah, after the sale, there's a blog post saying essentially they had no plans for changes, but who knows? Maybe Stanza will stay the same, but there'll be a new version of the iPhone app.
I'm reading Confessions of a Shopaholic.
Oh, that's a great book. That's a great book. But have you read it like a lot on the iPhone, or you read a lot of pages?
No, I just downloaded it just a second.
Oh,
from my Kindle.
Well, I just downloaded Myst, but you don't see me playing it. By the way,
I just wanted to show you what it looked like.
But yeah, well, I'm sure you're not.
It was for the show.
I'm sure you're not reading during the show.
No, I wouldn't do that ever.
Crazy. I am playing Myst, however.
Nor have I ever played World of Warcraft while on the show. I've never done that, really.
You say it makes me think you have. Are you playing World of Warcraft?
What? No, no.
You got
that
to
would be awful.
You got to 71. I saw.
No, I'm at 80 now.
You got to 80?
I got to 80. Yeah.
That's as high as you can go, right?
You can go, yep. Leveled out. Yeah, I'm sad. Let's not talk about it anymore. It's too depressing.
Level 80 Vixen Warrior.
Ooh, no. I am a Tauren Shaman. Oh, for the Horde.
A Tauren Shaman. For the Horde!
For the Horde.
Such nerds.
Moving on.
So sad. Just two losers sitting here.
I just totally rat-holed us, didn't I?
No, I love it. First of all, I love rat holes, but I love talking about World of Warcraft. And it's completely appropriate since I'm now going to play Myst. 773 megabytes was that download. It only takes, they say, 100 megabytes on the phone, but you need a free 773 to install it, I guess. I wonder how long this sync will take. Oh, boy.
But then you have Myst on your phone, so that's awesome.
Yeah, I can't wait. Before the show's over, I'll boot it up and we'll take a look at it. We're going to take a break, come back. The I would like your impressions of the DVD copying trial. This is a big, big story, which we have not yet covered. It's happening in San Francisco right now in the Ninth Circuit Court. It's Judge Marilyn Patel back to her old tricks. GoDaddy says, don't buy .TV. The island is sinking. And Windows 7 comes out Tuesday in release candidate 1. Supposedly the only release candidate. Before we do all of that, though, I do want to mention our friends at Citrix and GoToMeeting. Has anybody here used GoToMeeting? Just, you can be honest. You don't have to.
Yes.
No. What do you think, Dwight?
I liked it. I wasn't driving. It was for a meeting at work, but it worked quite well.
I'm using it more and more. In fact, we just asked for a few accounts for some of our hosts who are using it actually during the show to show screens, which is very cool. You said you've used it too, Harry?
You know, a fairly significant percentage of the demos people do for me these days are done via it.
Yeah. It's, everybody's moving to GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting from Citrix. They're the company that does GoToMyPC as well. They really know the ins and outs of Windows and how to do remote access in Windows. I don't think there's anybody better, frankly, at remote access than the Citrix folks. GoToMeeting, basically, here's the problem. You know, you're on a conference call. You're talking to somebody and you're showing them something visual. Or you're talking about something visual, a PowerPoint or a keynote presentation or a drawing or a slide. And you're describing it and it's just frustrating as heck. What you can do if you've got GoToMeeting installed is say, hey, well let me show you. This is kind of wild. And you go to you say go to GoToMeeting.com. It takes you about a click of the mouse to get it started. And then you tell them, go to GoToMeeting.com. Here's the meeting ID. And it's kind of cool because they go, wow. And they're looking at your computer on their screen, no matter where they are. They see the presentation. It's great for sales, great for product demos, for training, for collaboration, too. You can both work on a document together. Very affordable. And right now, free for 30 days when you use this special URL. GoToMeeting.com/twit. These guys, I have known these guys going back to Ed Iacobucci, who founded Citrix many moons ago. And I've always thought the world of them and their technology. It's secure. It's affordable. It's effective. GoToMeeting.com/twit. I invite you to give it a try. So Microsoft is going to Windows 7. According to Acer, Acer will have a Windows 7 PC available for sale October 23rd. Somebody's going to get spanked at Acer for that one. But it may even be sooner. Who knows? Maybe it'll be September, and then the Acer's just saying, but we're going to have our computer by October. Are you using Windows 7, Harry?
As we speak, I'm installing it on a netbook. I installed it on a larger laptop yesterday. I'm gearing up for Tuesday so I can have more hands-on experience with the release candidate. But I've been using the early preview version since last October, whenever it was released.
Yeah, I have 7000, which is the preview version on a number of PCs, and then the 7100 comes. I'm not a member of TechNet or MSDN, so I'm going to have to wait with the unwashed masses till Tuesday, but I look forward to trying it on Tuesday.
It's excellent. I think it's, in a lot of ways, even the beta was a better product than Vista.
That's got to be depressing, but that's true.
It's way better than Vista in a lot of ways, and my main concern is PC manufacturers don't have a great track record of making Windows look good on their machines because they load it up with demoware and junk, and they replace the Windows utilities with ones that aren't as good. And I think they might do that to 7.2, and I'm hoping that because, you know, 7 is all about making Windows less annoying, I hope the PC companies move in that spirit and don't mess it up because they totally could if they wanted to.
Well, Microsoft was on top of the manufacturers when Vista came out. I remember talking to product managers who were working on Vista at the time, and they were telling me they were leaning on the HPs and Dells and Sonys of the world not to crap it up as they had done with XP. And sure
slogan.
Enough, they did.
Don't crap it up.
Don't crap it up.
It's freaking fast. Don't mess with it.
But well, Microsoft the nice thing is in a much better position today to lecture people about not being annoying than they were even with Vista.
That's a good point. Yeah.
And a lot of companies already offer a ways to yank out the crapware.
Right.
You know, Sony and Dell both have ways when you configure a machine bought online to remove it.
You have to pay Sony extra for that.
Yeah, that's
bad. That bugs the hell out of
me. I think they rescinded that.
Did they change that?
I believe so.
That's like...
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, we were real worked up about that.
We would be glad to sell you a computer that runs fine, but you would have to give us an extra $100.
It was like $50, I think.
Yeah, it was expensive.
I think it was $50.
Right.
If I remember correctly. It's a lot
of
money.
I think that they'll end up doing the same thing they did before. I think that that's one of the ways that they subsidize the cost of PCs and one of the reasons why Microsoft can run the laptop hunters ads and people are buying $800 computers in them.
Totally. I'm worried it's short-term thinking, though. If you make some money now but annoy your customers enough, eventually they will move elsewhere. Hopefully. Well.
I love Windows 7. I think this is the best Windows in a long time, and I do hope they don't frack it up.
Yeah, I've been using the beta on my HP Mini 1000, and I've enjoyed it.
It runs on a netbook fine.
Yeah, runs great.
Runs as
it
well
left
as
me with only 4 gigs of space total, but you know.
Well, you have the you have an SSD drive in your Mini.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. By the way, I bought a Corsair SSD, 128 gig SSD, very pricey. They're $330 for only 128 gigs. Put it in my MacBook Pro. I am loving this. Does your Mini seem speedy because it's using an SSD? I don't know they can't put a very good one in there.
No, it's pretty fast. I haven't had any trouble with it.
Your Mini costs less than the hard drive I bought. But I have to say, it speeds up the MacBook, especially boot time is like very, very quick, and application launch very, very quick.
Which SSD did you buy?
The Corsair.
Oh, the Corsair.
We have a show with Ryan Shroud of PC Perspective and Alan Malventano, and Alan is like the king of SSDs. He's tested them all, and they talked me into it. I said, well, I don't want to spend $800 for 64 gigs for the Intel X25, and they said, no, you don't need to. You could buy the cheaper Corsair. You get more space, less money, and it's just as fast. And I have to say, I've been blown away. I think this is the future. I think what you're going to see in PCs going forward is solid state drives for the boot and the applications, and then a terabyte or 2 terabyte spinning drive for the extra storage for media and all the other stuff you use.
You don't think eventually that the price of SSDs will come down to the point that you can have terabyte?
Yeah, wouldn't that be great? The problem is, they've got the price on mechanical drives. I'm buying terabyte drives for $80 now.
Right.
$150 for 2 terabyte drives. It's just mind boggling. I would never have, Harry, PC World, if I had told you 6 years ago, oh, you'll be able to get 2 terabytes for $150, you would have laughed at me.
Laughed in their face.
Yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable.
The one dependably popular story we ever did at PC World was always, hard drives reach X for X amount of dollars. And even when it was like them reaching 100 megabytes for God knows how much, that was a big story. And I feel like 10 years from now, it'll still be a big story.
I just can't. I mean, 10 years from now, what is it going to be? Oh, yeah, I got a couple of petabytes running, on solid state. That's amazing. So I don't know. I don't know if GoDaddy was just looking for headlines or what, but when you go to GoDaddy and try to buy a .tv domain now, a pop-up comes up that says, don't buy this. The island is sinking.
I can't believe GoDaddy would ever do anything solely for publicity. That
never.
Would be beneath
how dare they?
Sinking island.
Island
no,
sinking? What the heck? It says... Why choose .tv? Note, but .tv, by the way, is Tuvalu, the island of Tuvalu, which is in fact sinking. I mean, it's not a joke. They say, note, the island of Tuvalu is sinking. Recommended alternatives are .com, .net, .info.
If it goes away, does the domain go away?
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah, what happens to it? Like, what difference does it make?
Makes a difference to me. All my domains are .tv. What do I do? I don't have twit.com. I have twit.tv. If twit.tv goes away, if it sinks, I'm sunk.
It kind of sounds like a...
You think
like
it's
just a
publicity?
Yeah,
I hope
publicity
so.
Stunt.
You could switch to twit.at, which is for Atlantis.
Yeah, they'll give Tuvalu the Atlantis designation.
That's then, right. Yeah.
I don't. FM is Federated Micronesia. I use AM because that's, but that's Armenia. But yeah, TV is Tuvalu. And it is, in fact, it's just a little volcanic island that's slowly sinking. It, by the way, somebody said, boy, that's for you to worry about that is pretty coarse because, I mean, what about the people who live there? But it's
I'm pretty sure the people have been steadily moving off for the past few
resettled.
Years, actually.
And there's only a few hundred of them.
Yeah. That's sad, though.
And I've been spending a lot of money on their .tv domain. They got a lot of my money.
They should be rebuilding with your money.
Yeah, build a, you know, get some floats.
Maybe they'll have their own little state in Australia and it'll survive.
I'm going to call ICANN and say, please, can you assign it to somebody else so I can buy it?
Their royal anthem. I'm looking at the Tuvalu, I guess that's how you pronounce it. I'm looking at the Tuvalu website and their anthem is God Save the Queen.
Well, yeah, they're probably a British.
Part of the Commonwealth.
It's weird when you go to Canada, when you're in Canada, they play God Save the Queen. The Queen's on their money. Yeah, they're part of the Commonwealth.
Yeah, they don't really do anything. I actually had a big discussion about this with our Canadian crew because we were just up in Vancouver shooting. And we were asked, well, we were just in England. So what's the real relationship between Canada and the UK and with England especially? And they're like, well, it's just kind of symbolic. Like we have our own parliament.
It's not. You know why it's not?
Because
there's a... And you should
ask this is Canadians that told me this, so
yeah.
I'm interested to know.
But they know, and they just weren't thinking, but there's a Canadian... The Queen appoints a governor general. There's a governor, and she's got some power, because there's a term for it, I can't remember what it is, but there were during this recent battle between the Conservatives and Labour, with Stephen Harper, and there was a whole thing going on. What is the governor general can dissolve the government, and then there's this weird thing that she can do.
There's a huge argument going on in the chat room now.
They're going,
by
no,
the
she
way.
Doesn't. She doesn't. She doesn't. But there is, and I remember I read a whole article about this. Prorogue. She can prorogue Parliament. She's not an elected official. She's a representative of the Queen's government in Canada. And I presume appointed by the Queen, and she has this power. Considerable power with the government.
That's very interesting.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
But it has to be a very... Oh, the prime minister appoints the governor general? Oh, never mind. I take it all back. She's fracking useless. 60% of... we're going to end with this story. There is a guy who wrote, by the way, a program. I love this. That will eliminate the mentions of Twitter from this show. I encourage you all to get it. It's a little Python program that actually goes through the whole show and redacts any sentence that has the word
through
Twitter.
Through the audio show?
Yes.
Wow.
It redacts the words and the sentence that has the word Twitter in it throughout the entire show. It's brilliant.
And it works?
Well, I didn't actually try it. It's called Twitter Killer. And, it's from dingoskidneys.com. I'm thinking he's Australian. I might be wrong. It says it's a Twitter killer, a twit podcast improver. Like many of you, I grew tired of listening to This Week in Tech.
God.
And the panel blabbering on and on about how amazing Twitter is. I enjoy the rest of the show, but they have to ruin it with their incessant fawning. Not anymore. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you... You know, he's going to do another one. Kill Leo's bad accents. That's what we really need. I present to you Twitter Killer. This fabulous program uses Pocket Sphinx to detect, mark, and edit out sentences containing the word Twitter.
Can he do one for Scoble that deletes FriendFeed?
Ooh, hey, snap.
I like FriendFeed. We're using FriendFeed now. In fact, we have a Twit Conversations room, and we get a lot of, you know, really interesting comments via FriendFeed.
We were good in this episode with not talking about Twitter.
Well, that's why I mentioned this, that you may want this program, because I'm going to give you one last story that actually mentions Twitter. You know, I do that because there's a Twitter drinking game for people who are listening to the show, and they're parched. And I want them to have a little beverage here. 60%, according to Nielsen, 60% of Twitter users are Twitter quitters. They don't return the following month.
No, I believe that. I think that's right.
I think, you know, Twitter has a problem because it's very easy to sign up for and use. but it's a lot harder to get any value out of it. It takes you a while to figure it out.
It's kind of like if you either get it or you don't, and then you figure that out pretty quickly if this is something that's going to be interesting to you.
I don't know. I think if I look at my usage, I signed up in December 2006, and it took me about 4 or 5 months before I used it again. And then
I think for a lot of people, not signing up, trying it, not understanding it, going away is part of the process of eventually getting it. Because I certainly tried it and did not know what I was doing and came back after a while. So I would bet even though the people who love Twitter, a fairly high percentage, abandoned it for a while. And Twitter is trying to make it easier to get going because originally, you know, you had no friends when you signed up, and they are now recommending some folks.
Yeah, that's what the suggested friends are about, and why with, you know, if they're going for the mainstream, that's why there's so many celebrities in it, is that they're trying to hook you that way. But yeah, when you first get there, it's like an empty room. And I think most people look around and go, okay, now what do I do? And they don't come back. But then once they do come back, and if they kind of work it and look through their friends and look through their friends' followers, they end up kind of figuring out what to do. But initially, yeah, it's like an echo chamber. There's nothing there.
Dave, why
I just finally added search for everybody this week.
Yeah, that helps.
That's a huge help. Yeah, because you could search for swine flu and get a lot of content. And then you can follow people. I think that's actually better and more important than the suggested users, because if you search for something you're interested in, you can see who's talking about it and add them as friends. That's how you build a friends list.
Well, another thing, too, I don't think they're taking into account with the study is people using desktop applications, which may not reflect the numbers in the same way that web users do.
Yeah,
and
I
think
counting more websites, people, you're right. Yeah.
Right. So that probably does have an effect on this study.
Facebook this week announced that an open stream initiative, which I thought was kind of interesting. Facebook's looking more and more like Twitter. I don't know if you've noticed. And I would love to see, I think Facebook missed a bet a little bit. Essentially what they announced only meant that, it was easier for third party developers to create Twitter style applications to access Facebook, and Microsoft was there and Adobe was there and Seismic was there. What I'd love to see though is for Facebook to open up much more completely so that you could, for instance, follow people on Facebook. You know, they say, well, we'd like to do that, but our privacy commitments don't allow us to do so. But wouldn't it be, don't you think that's one way Facebook could suddenly overtake and beat, well, overtake, they've got 200 million users, but they could completely put Twitter out of business by just saying, well, follow the people you're interested in at Facebook. Would you do that?
I guess if they make better use of pages, as opposed to just having private profiles, if you could follow pages or got more people into interested in following pages as opposed to just friending people.
That's what they're trying to do is make them
landing pages where you can get all the information about the people you're interested in and then still be able to have a dialogue with them. So it's a little bit, there's a lot more information there than maybe you would get from following someone on Twitter.
Sure.
But you just have to get the people, the eyeballs there, to use that trite term.
If they end up with a total 180.
Go ahead, Harry.
It's a total 180 because I think, at least until recently, and maybe even now, Mark Zuckerberg said that Facebook is not even for meeting new people. Facebook is for kind of organizing the people you know in the real world online. And obviously, Twitter is nothing like that. Twitter is for meeting new people and even following people you'll never meet. And I think Facebook has to get their head around whether they want to.
I use them differently. I use Facebook. Well, I don't use them appropriately, but I would use Facebook to keep track of friends and family. And Twitter is more an informational tool where you follow people who say things that are interesting.
Yeah, Twitter is increasingly for me used with search and increasingly used for both direct interaction with people who read me and who I'm interested in following. But when I go over to Facebook, I'm looking at my coworkers, my family, my friends, and it's a completely different culture. And it's kind of odd that Facebook, almost in terms of the features it's trying to bring in and the design that it's moving towards, is almost obsessed with Twitter. It wants to be Twitter, but it's like you said, it's already bigger and it's a completely different thing. I think to paraphrase that 80s phrase, you ought to let Facebook be Facebook.
Yeah. I like that.
That's. I think they definitely have a little bit of an identity crisis right now, because, like we mentioned earlier, it's meant to organize the people you know in the real world, yet they see the success that Twitter is having, and they want to implement some of those features, but that doesn't work with the way they're set up. So it's becoming a clash of ideals there a little bit.
It's irritated a lot of users, too, with that setup.
Got to be careful about the irritating the users. You could lose. I mean, it all comes down to the fact that none of these services are meaningful at all unless users pour content into it. They live on us, right? They don't. It's interesting because these are sites that are created not because the site. It's completely the opposite of the Houston Chronicle or the New York Times, where you go to the site because the site creates content. There is no content on Facebook or Twitter or Dig or a lot of these sites without us.
Content on Facebook is a weird thing, too, because it's really hard to take anywhere with you. It's hard to, like, if I leave a video comment on someone's page, I can't tag myself within that comment. That video doesn't then show up in my video section of Facebook. It's like a total separate entity. There's not a lot of usefulness there for me in that kind of sense. That's why I don't create a lot of content for Facebook in particular.
Right. Yeah, it's a different group of people that uses it, that's for sure. Hey, we're going to wrap this up. I just wanted to put the Twitter story at the end so that we could test this program and see how much shorter the show is without it. By the way, he has a setting. You can also reverse it and cut out everything except the Twitter mentions for those of you who want a really short show this week. Hey, Veronica, I'm so glad you could be here. Veronica Belmont is the host of Techzilla. She does that with my buddy Patrick Norton, and also on Core for Sony, which brings her all around the world. Q-O-R-E. You can subscribe to it on your PlayStation 3. Do you have to have a PlayStation 3?
Yes.
Okay. It's on your. It's a PlayStation 3.
Sometimes it's on YouTube, too.
Shh.
Don't tell.
Is that illegal?
More.
Is that not right?
Yeah, right. We don't do that.
No.
We don't agree with that at all.
No. Bad idea. And I thank you. It's great to see you, Veronica. Thank you for being here. Harry McCracken is
thank
the
you.
Technologizer. It's very gubernator of you, the technologizer. How's that going? We first talked to you when you had left PC World and started it up. It's been about, it's 8 months now, something like that?
Yeah, it's a little over that. I guess the site turns one in June, so I'm almost there, and it's been great. This is the best job I ever had, and I've had some pretty cool jobs in the past, so it's saying a lot.
It's really encouraging that somebody can strike out on their own, and I think there are a lot of reporters working for newspapers that are slowly pulling a Tuvalu who are saying, this is good. This is good news. We can go out, strike out on our own, create content, and make a living.
It's doable. And, you know, I don't need to make millions of dollars for anybody to be a success. So it's the bar for being a success is fairly low, and it's doable.
It's kind of like, I mean, it's kind of what I'm doing too, right? Is you know,
we're an inspiration.
Yeah, the TV left me, so I started my own little TV station. I love it. Dwight Silverman is still an ink-stained wretch at the Houston Chronicle.
I'm mostly on the web, so I don't have as much ink on me as I used to.
There's no ink from the web, huh?
No, there's a little grease and a few leftover bits, but other than that.
I love it.
And you and Harry are my heroes. I love that people can strike out on their own and make it. And someday I may end up doing that. We'll see.
We all do it, really. I mean, I think that ultimately that's the future is you have this brand around yourself and you come and you offer that. That's what you offer of value. It's always been what you've offered of value. But now I think the individual is a little bit more valued than it used to be thanks to the internet. I think that's really great. I think it's really great. Well, thanks all of you for being here. Folks, I want to mention a concert that I'm going to go to on Memorial Day. It's a charitable event. It's May 25th in San Francisco. It's called Let the Sunshine In. It benefits Christopher Rodriguez and the Scholarship Fund of the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. And I wanted to give him a plug because it's really cool. Christopher, it's very sad. He was 11 years old, was hit by a stray bullet while he was at a piano lesson. He's paralyzed from the waist down. You can read about it. We've made a tiny URL for you. tinyurl.com/ChristopherRodriguez. There's a link to buy tickets if there are any left at the city box office. I am so excited. I'm going to see Sting, Bob Weir, Mary Wilson of the Supremes, Marilyn Monroe, and Billy Davis Jr., The Fifth Dimension. Of course, Michael Narada Walden, because it's his foundation that's doing this. It's all at Davies Symphony Hall, Monday, May 25th, 7 p.m., and I invite you to find out more about it. at cityboxoffice.com or tinyurl.com/Christopher Rodriguez. You should come to, you and Ryan should come to this, Veronica. It's going to be really, really cool.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah. I get to see, I get to meet Sting. I'm so excited. I'm so excited. Well, thank you, everybody. We appreciate your being here. If you like Twit, or even if you don't, make sure you go to the iTunes store and look for the podcast section and then search for Twit. There are many shows in there in the Twit family of shows, including this one, and you can subscribe to them, download them, and listen to them automatically. We also kind of broadcast our taping session every Sunday afternoon at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific. That's 2000 UTC at live.twit.tv, and you can watch. It's actually becoming more and more of a video show, thanks to Colleen and Skypeosaurus back here. We got all three of you on video. Look at them. Look at their shiny, smiling faces. Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Another Twit.
This is amazing.
Is in the can.